Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from our studios in central London, I'm Julian Marshall. Ukraine is expected to dominate the Munich Security Conference, with European leaders trying to make sense of President Trump's peace plan for Ukraine, which seems to involve Russia keeping the territory it's gained through the invasion of its neighbour and Ukraine blocked from joining NATO. So there was a lot of expectation that the US Vice President J.D. Vance might give them more details of the American proposals when he made his keynote speech to the conference earlier on today, except that he didn't elaborate.
We gather at this conference, of course, to discuss security, and normally we mean threats to our external security. I see many great military leaders gathered here today. But while the Trump administration is very concerned with European security and believes that we can come to a reasonable settlement between Russia and Ukraine, and we also believe that it's important in the coming years for Europe to step up in a big way to provide for its own defense, the threat that I worry the most about vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, it's not China, it's not any other external actor. And what I worry about is the threat from within.
And Mr. Vance went on to launch into a fiery broadside against Europe for what he claimed was its retreat from some of its most fundamental values through restrictions on free speech, content moderation rules online, and political firewalls against radical parties. He also urged European leaders to listen to voters' concerns about uncontrolled migration rather than running scared of them.
But the crisis this continent faces right now, the crisis I believe we all face together, is one of our own making. If you're running in fear of your own voters, there is nothing America can do for you. Nor, for that matter, is there anything that you can do for the American people who elected me and elected President Trump. You need democratic mandates to accomplish anything of value in the coming years. Have we learned nothing that thin mandates produce unstable results? But there is so much of value that can be accomplished with the kind of democratic mandate that I think will come from being more responsive to the voices of your citizens.
J.D. Vance and the German Defence Minister Boris Pistorius responded directly to Mr. Vance's comments at the start of his own address to the conference.
Wir kämpfen auch dafür, dass du gegen uns sein kannst.
We're fighting for your right to be against us. That's one of the mottos of the German army, and it also stands for our democracy. This democracy was just called into question by the US Vice President, for Europe as a whole. He spoke of the annulment of democracy, and, if I understood him correctly, he compares the conditions in parts of Europe with those in authoritarian regimes. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not acceptable.
Well, I spoke earlier to Carl Bildt, a former Swedish prime minister and foreign minister, who was in the room in Munich when Mr. Vance spoke. What was going through his mind as he listened?
It was profound silence in the audience because people were, well, slightly stunned. What was he up to? To try to say to the Europeans that the main security problem in the world or for Europe is the limitation of free speech in Europe is profoundly bizarre. That it surprised even the people who didn't expect very much from the speech. And then he went on from that to what sounded nearly like an election speech in the German election campaign in favor of the far right. So it was quite an unusual experience, to put it in those terms.
And what did you object to? What he said or the platform on which he said it?
Well, of course, the combination. Here he had a platform that he was addressing for the first time for the new American administration. What you could sort of describe as the European security and foreign policy elite. I mean, it's broader than that. There's a lot of people from all over the world. But clearly, nearly everyone who is anything in European security and foreign policy. And then he has nothing absolutely to say about relevant foreign and security problems and goes into completely bizarre theories on domestic affairs of Europe. People were stunned.
People were stunned, but did they in any way take note, do you think? Did you take note of any of the things he was saying?
I didn't find anything that was particularly relevant, I have to say. the fact that migration is a concern and is an issue in virtually every single election campaign in Europe is hardly news. We all knew that. We don't need to be preached by the Vice President of the United States on that one. And then his entire theory building of free speech being sort of under threat or danger in Europe is, of course, so divorced from reality that one wonders what's the objective of this.
Is there a clash of cultures going on here?
We should not forget that there are limitations on free speech in the United States as well. I mean, they have defamation laws that I think goes further than, for example, what we have in Sweden. They have laws against obscenity that goes nudity, for example, that goes substantially, of, you know, if you care about that, substantially beyond what we have in Europe. So they have their limitations as well. But to portray this as a huge issue in Europe, then to sort of support different sort of extreme far-right elements is, to put it in those terms, it's not what the transatlantic relationship used to be about.
I mean, he singled out Sweden and said the laws there supposedly protect free expression, but they do not. In fact, they grant, and I'm quoting, a free pass to do or say anything without risking offending the group that holds that belief.
No, we have probably among the most liberal legislation that you can find anywhere in Europe on these particular issues. But hate speech, yes, there's a limit. And the courts have to decide that. And this was a rather controversial case. And the courts decided that in this particular case, it was hate speech.
So where does this leave relations, do you think, between the Trump administration and Europe?
Well, it remains to be seen. But of course, we have seen several other things in the last few days. We have the Secretary of Defense making these sort of vast concessions to Russia and Ukraine. We had this sort of telephone call between, or rather the description of the telephone call. I mean, the telephone call might be one thing, but the description that Mr. Trump gave of his intentions with Russia, taking them back in the G7, mutual state visits and whatever. And now we had the Vance speech here. So it's been somewhat unsettling, to put it in the mildest possible way.
I mean, do you think the United States is being serious in any regard? I mean, particularly with regard to any peace plan for Ukraine.
I fail to see that they have a peace plan. They clearly have the intention of making peace. I mean, Mr. Trump said he was going to do that in 24 hours. He's now going to say it's going to take a couple of months. That's not wrong in itself. But if that takes him into sort of a new Munich agreement, where so he and Mr. Putin sits down and try to draw the new lines on the border of the east of Europe and decide the future of Ukraine, then, of course, it is somewhat objectionable.
That was former Swedish Prime Minister Carl Bildt. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucet, is also in Munich. Did she agree with Mr. Bildt's assessment that the audience was somewhat stunned by Mr. Vance's speech?
I think he's being very diplomatic. The German defense minister, as you heard, Boris Pistorius, saying that the vice president of the United States seemed to want to look at Europe through the lens of autocratic regimes, so not seeing them at all in the way one would expect of such an important strategic ally. And on top of it, at a conference rooted in the idea of this vital transatlantic partnership, there was very little applause during J.D. Vance's speech because, quite frankly, as you highlighted, the issue on the agenda was Ukraine, and more to the point, how President Trump has decided he wants to resolve it, because it has provoked deep, deep anxiety here, most of all among the Ukrainians.
I mean, on Ukraine, have you been able to glean any kind of progress or any discussion, any substantive discussions on what President Trump has been proposing?
Well, if we just roll back a bit to that first of all, the 90-minute conversation between President Trump and President Putin, which was widely viewed here shocking, we didn't hear that much about from President Trump about what they discussed, but what was reflected by his defense secretary, Peter Hegseth, made it clear that issues that should be at the negotiating table are now off the table. Issues like NATO, that in his words, Peter Hegseth's words, that you have to be realistic, that Ukraine will never join NATO, that they can't look to the pre-2014 borders, that is when Russia first invaded Ukraine, and that Europe had to be responsible for the security guarantees. There would not be any US troops involved. That has really, really angered people here and caused great worry. The former head of the Munich Security Conference, Wolfgang Ischinger, told me that the rules-based international order is basically shattered now, with President Trump being seen to reward the aggression of President Putin. But the talking goes on night and day here in the formal sessions, in the corridors, in bilateral meetings. And Europeans are hoping that in these talks they can try to nudge the Americans forward and try to come up with what they believe is essential if there is to be a just peace in Ukraine, and that is a unified position among the Europeans, the Americans, and the Ukrainians. But I have to say, Julian, one thing everyone agrees on is that at last the discussions are starting, even if that they are now clouded by distrust and disagreement and, quite frankly, disappointment. But at least they're moving, and they have to hope they're moving in the right direction. Just too much is at stake, not just Ukraine, but Europe's future.
And did anything come out of the meeting between President Zelensky and J.D. Vance?
We're not clear yet. We still don't really have a full readout of exactly what happened. I think, first of all, President Zelensky, there was a discussion earlier in the day whether or not the meetings would be cancelled after what the U.S. Defense Secretary had said. It was delayed, but it finally did happen. And even though they were both very diplomatic before the talk started, no doubt there would have been very, very candid discussions, because the U.S. administration seems to have a take it or leave it kind of approach to this, that they believe that they know the best way forward. And quite frankly, they see it as Europe's problem, that Europe has to pay for Ukraine's defense, put the troops on the ground, and President Trump will just be the peacemaker to do the deal. But now there's doubts about that deal.
That was our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, in Munich. And later in the programme, we'll be discussing the significance of ongoing talks on America's access to Ukraine's mineral deposits. And we report on the desperation of Ukrainians after nearly 3 years of war, and whether that means they'll accept peace at any cost. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour Live from the BBC in London. Now, we've all been there, haven't we? You've had a big meal, maybe a starter and a main course. You're feeling full up. But when the offer of a dessert comes, magically, you feel like you've still got space in your already bloated belly. The joke is that we have another separate stomach for desserts. Not true, of course, but it seems there is a biological reason why we're able to carry on eating sweet things even when we've really had enough to eat. And it was uncovered by researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Metabolism Research in Germany through a study of mice. Team leader Dr. Henning Fenslau has been telling my colleague James Menendez more.
What we found in mice is that once we are in a state of satiety, so when we have enough food eaten after a meal, for example, that there's a switch that occurs that activates this specific neurons in the brain that then ultimately make us guide towards eating more high sugar-containing foods.
And so the brain gets a signal that it's full, but what is the other message that it's sending out?
So the message it's sending out is that the consumption of sugar is very pleasant. And so that should then ultimately still be consumed, even though there is, in general, the fullness sensation.
And this message is via what? An opiate endorphin. I mean, I think people know what endorphins are because they make you feel very good indeed. It's a feeling of reward, is it?
Exactly. So that is also being produced in the brain. And there is one specific endorphin or opiate, which is beta endorphin. And there's actually only one cell type in the brain that produces beta endorphin, which are POMC cells. And so these POMC cells are really widely known for being the brain regulator for satiety. But they do so with a very different molecule, which is called alpha MSH. It's a very well-known signaling mechanism. But they produce also better endorphin. It was a long-standing question, why do they have this? And we think that we, with our investigation, provided a new idea how and why they have this to drive this overconsumption of high sugar-containing foods.
And why do you think this mechanism exists?
We consider this something that is evolutionarily there, because in the wild, sugar is extremely rare, right? I mean, there are only few sources where sugar in its pure source can be found. And so whenever there an animal can find sugar, it should consume it because it's very easy ingestible. And even though you have a sufficient amount of energy stored in the body, you can consume this sugar to use it to actually build up more energy, which obviously in times where food was scarce, it was an important mechanism to have more energy for later time points.
And it is only sugar, isn't it? It's not other types of food that this happens with.
It seems so, yeah. All our data strongly suggests that it's only sugar that this mechanism drives.
Of course, these days, sugar is everywhere. So could this discovery be used to try and control our sugar intake? Is there a way of inhibiting these brain messages?
There is a way to block it or to inhibit it, because you can block the opiate receptor. And we think or suggest there could actually be a way how to maybe complement are really available strategies or come up with new strategies to treat patients that overconsume and may have a higher body weight.
So in other words, we just feel full and that's it. We won't want to eat that lovely dessert in front of us.
That is the hope, of course. I mean, that requires many, many more investigations. But from a principal perspective, yes, that is the idea that we want to find out if that is possible.
That was Dr. Henning Fenslau of the Max Planck Institute for Metabolism Research in Germany. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Do stay with us. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes. You're with NewsHour. And now to the Egyptian sportswoman whose pregnancy during the Paris Olympics stunned the world. After her last 16 exit, Fencer Nada Hafez revealed she'd competed while 7 months pregnant. She's been speaking to BBC Sport Africa's Nishat Lada.
I'm a competitive person. What I was thinking about my baby, that I want to be the Olympian and my baby to be an Olympian and to do something different for my baby. So, yeah, my baby motivated me for this.
27-year-old Egyptian fencer Nada Hafez is a clinical pathologist by trade and a new mum to 4-month-old daughter Zaina. She'd already competed at Rio 2016 and Tokyo 2020, but the Paris Olympics were more than just participation. In the first round of her women's individual sabre, she pulled off a shock win against seventh-seeded American Elizabeth Tartakovsky.
I had this dream to not stop and to continue fencing and to continue and chase my dream. So when I did it, finally, it was like, I can't believe it. And I won a very difficult match. So this was the dream coming true for me.
Hafez lost her next match, but reaching the last 16 was something special. And then came the Instagram post, which made headline news the world over.
Now the latest from Paris 2024, where the Egyptian fencer Nada Hafez has revealed she competed at the Olympics while 7 months pregnant. Hafez appearing...
I was just posting this on my personal account, saying that I'm on top 16 in the world while pregnant, and I didn't expect that this will go viral. I was very proud that an Egyptian Arab woman can tell the world that you can do it, your body can surprise you, that we have strength that you will never know about it. You just have to experience it. I read all the messages from women, and actually not only women, there are young girls. They told me, you inspired us so much and we want to go to medical school. I want to continue in sports. When I get a message from anyone telling me that I'm an example or a role model, it's really big. It set my heart on fire.
But not all the messages were so kind. Hafez put out another post to clarify she was fine to compete.
I didn't understand what people are talking about, because some people, they're saying you can leave another place for another one to fence. And This is not an option because I'm qualified by my name. So I didn't take anyone's place, for example. People, you just put a message and it's easy to put a comment on the post and run. You don't face me. Some people, they don't want to see a successful woman.
The Egyptian Olympic Committee confirmed to us that they have no problem with a pregnant woman competing as long as they're sure it's safe for her and her baby. Hafez has not yet decided whether she'll try to qualify for LA 2028. She's studying for a master's and using her platform to support women's rights in sport.
Sometimes you need to see an example in front of you to know that you can do it. Because maybe a pregnant woman, she's just afraid to move, she's afraid to do anything. And now she just tells herself, there's an Olympian woman that she competes at the Olympics while pregnant. So I can do whatever it is. And I wanted to give a message for all women that you don't have a disease. You're just a normal woman and you're pregnant.
That was Egyptian fencer Nada Hafez. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. Well, the US Vice President J.D. Vance did get around to speaking about Ukraine today in Munich. In a meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president had previously said that there should be no discussion about ending the war in Ukraine without the involvement of Ukraine, and that the only Russian official he was prepared to speak to about peace negotiations was President Putin. As to his meeting with J.D. Vance.
Well, we're thankful for American support, President Trump. We have good conversation today, our first meeting, not last, I'm sure, and really what we need to speak more, to work more, and to prepare the plan how to stop Putin and finish the war. We want peace very much, but we need real security guarantees, and we will continue our meetings.
Well, no details have emerged about what was discussed at the meeting, but it's thought that the two men spoke about a plan for American exploitation of Ukraine's rare earth minerals in exchange for US security guarantees. Our teams will continue to work on the plan, Mr. Zelensky said on X after the meeting, referring to the minerals deal with the US. US Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who earlier was in a roundtable discussion with President Zelensky at the Munich conference, suggested that doing the deal would encourage the US to protect Ukraine.
Putin doesn't understand what's going on. If we sign this minerals agreement, Putin is screwed because Trump will defend the deal. So the best thing that's going to happen here is he's going to do a deal with you, I hope, and he will defend America's interest.
And I spoke earlier to Timofey Milovanov, who a former economy minister in Ukraine and now the president of Kiev School of Economics, which has assessed the minerals in Ukraine. He told me more about them and their potential value.
They're very heterogeneous in their value because some of them are very difficult to get or they are in, you know, even close to the front lines. Others are being developed even as we speak, Titan, for example. Some of them have very high value. Others basically are not commercially viable. But it is in hundreds of billions at the very least in the immediate term. That would require a lot of investment, though.
And negotiations would seem to be quite well advanced with the United States. The Treasury Secretary was in Kiev earlier on this week. Are you privy to the terms of any deal?
Not really. I've spoken with some people who might know the details of the deal. I think it's, the structuring of the deal is in very early stages. The idea, everyone is agreeing on the idea, both Ukraine and the United States. The question, of course, is the implementation. Who has the property rights? What are the conditions? It's a lot of money. It's a lot of commercial processes. It's a lot of environmental regulations. All of that has to be worked out.
And as Senator Graham said, I mean, if America does come to have these massive mining concessions in Ukraine, it is going to be inclined to defend the country.
Yes, I think so. There are a lot of other additional benefits, both for Ukraine and, of course, for the United States. There will be investment. There will be business activity. There will be direct incentives to protect. But it also creates some kind of framework to speak with Putin about where the front line is going to be, or the sort of contact line, because now the United States has incentives to move this contact line further in the interest of Ukraine.
Yes, I mean, on that particular point, I mean, how much of these minerals is in Ukrainian proper and territory currently controlled by the Russians?
My understanding that the discussion is happening over the minerals and elements which are under Ukrainian control and can be developed. But there are, of course, elements which are in the areas which are currently under occupation or are disputed, or the front line, or the active fighting combat operations happening. So I think that is a bonus and might be a significant bonus to the peace deal if those areas are returned to Ukraine.
That was Timofey Milivanov, a former economy minister in Ukraine and now the president of Kiev School of Economics. Well, Ukrainians themselves have been reduced to bystanders for the moment as world leaders discuss possible ways of an end to Russia's full-scale invasion of their country nearly 3 years ago. They're currently in a state of frozen limbo. Moscow's devastating invasion has shattered lives and leveled cities across the country. South of Zaporizhia, on the banks of a reservoir now drained after the destruction of vital dam, James Waterhouse asked people what possible future they can imagine.
The gap through the barbed wire fence takes you to this, a dried out fish farm with crusted earth, and you can see a boat sitting in a frozen puddle. You feel exposed in many ways. It's -8. The wind makes it feel lower, and the Russians are just over the hill where you can hear incoming artillery. Alexander and his father were fishermen, but the war means he is out of work. So what happened?
In 2023, they blew up the Kakhovka Dam and drained the water from the reservoir completely. Back then, we had about 40 people working for us. Now, everything is overgrown. The boats have become unusable. I have no plans for the future at all. I woke up today. That's already pretty good. That's about it.
Lyudmila is telling us about her village's new well. It was installed after the reservoir drained, and locals rely on it for their drinking water. Ukrainians here and across the country are facing two major battles: the horrors of daily life in a war zone and the uncertainty of peace, particularly one that is drawn up by Moscow and Washington, pressing questions for a settlement 15 kilometres from the front line.
It's like living on top of a volcano. The glide bombs fly over our village. It's horrible. You hear booms all the time. The plaster in the house falls off after every strike.
Can I just ask you about how you feel about the future, where it's increasingly looking like Russian forces aren't going to be going anywhere, and how you feel about Ukraine with a ceasefire?
We want this very much. Our village has been shelled 3 times already. We hope that the United States and Europe will continue to support us. We really believe that they won't abandon us. We want to believe.
After a ceasefire, this town could suddenly find itself on a more permanent border with its old enemy, Russia. Issues like rebuilding the destroyed dam, getting enough water, restoring industry lie at the heart of this village's and this country's future. All the while, as politicians talk, Ukrainians are still fighting and dying. Scenes like this which are fueling Ukrainian fatigue. In this cemetery, where more than half the graves are freshly dug, Alexander, a soldier, is laid to rest. 10 metres in the other direction is a trench, a defensive position next to the dry riverbed.
in case the Russians advance this far north. And the service can only last 25 minutes or so because of the very real threat of artillery.
Alexander was a very kind, compassionate man. He worked as a builder all his life, and then he went to defend our country.
His devastated wife, Natalia, tells us she's desperate for the fighting to end, but sees no way out of this war.
How long can this war go on for, then?
I don't have hope. They just keep sending more and more of our boys. If only they would find some way to end it. I just want it to end as soon as possible.
BBC's James Waterhouse with that report from south of Zaporizhia in Ukraine. Now, it's one of the best-known stories in the Old Testament of the Christian Bible, how God sent a whale to swallow Jonah after a shipwreck, kept him alive for 3 days, and encouraged him to repent. It is, of course, a fable, but the idea of being swallowed by a whale is not, it seems, so outlandish. It happened briefly to Adrian Simancas, who was kayaking with his father, Del, in the seas off Chilean Patagonia, a huge humpback whale that took man and kayak into his mouth before spitting them out again, and all captured on film by his father. This is when it happened.
Hey, ya, vente, vente. Tranquilo, agarra el bote, agárralo, tranquilo, agárralo. Agárralo, agárralo, no te subas, agárralo.
Tranquilo, agárralo. His son Adrian told the BBC's Spanish language Mundo service what had happened to him.
Me llamo Adrián Simancas, tengo 23 años.
My name is Adrian Simancas. I'm 23 years old. We've been rowing for about 2 hours. We had the weather in our favor. We had everything under control until, at that moment, I felt something hit me from behind and it closed in on me, sinking me and everything else in a second. I caught a glimpse of it as a medium dark blue and white color with a slimy texture that brushed my face. At that moment, I closed my eyes, expecting an impact, but it felt more like he turned me over, not that he crashed into me. And in that moment, I was kind of lying down. I spent a second realizing that I was inside the mouth of something that might have eaten me. That could have been a killer whale or a sea monster. But then, when I started to feel myself rising to the surface, which was when it spat me out, I went up for 2 seconds and finally reached the surface and realized that it hadn't eaten me, that it wasn't a predator. But being a whale, it could still pose danger if it jumped or tried to do the same with my dad, out of curiosity or playfulness. All that was for a second that I was kind of in his mouth, and then 2 seconds coming out of there. There was also a little bit of fear that if I was going to manage to hold my breath, because I didn't know how deep the breathing was. It was like another shock when I saw the video. I hadn't seen the moment when the back is showing and the fin is visible. I didn't see it in person, but I heard it. I got nervous and everything, but later in the video I realized that it did indeed show itself to me with a huge size, that perhaps if I had seen it, I would have been even more frightened.
That was Adrian Simancas on how close he came to being swallowed by a massive humpback whale. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. And we return to J.D. Vance's speech, or should I call it lecture, to European leaders at the Munich Security Conference today. As we heard earlier in the programme, many of those in the room were stunned as the US Vice President launched a withering attack against European policies on immigration, populist parties and free speech, echoing President Trump, whom he called Washington's new sheriff in town.
The threat that I worry the most about vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, it's not China, it's not any other external actor. And what I worry about is the threat from within, the retreat of Europe from some of its most fundamental values, values shared with the United States of America. In Britain and across Europe, free speech, I fear, is in retreat.
Well, we brought together Michael Schellenberger, the CBR Chair of Politics, Censorship and Free Speech at the University of Austin and the founder of Public News, and Natalie Tocci, an Italian political scientist and director of the Italian Institute of International Affairs. Michael, first of all, what did he think was the intention behind Mr. Vance's brazen speech?
Well, I think it shocked a lot of us, too. I mean, we didn't expect this. They've moved very assertively to defend our free speech rights, including on social media platforms. But I think it's also long overdue. I mean, we've, you know, I don't know if Europeans understand just how deep American concern for freedom of speech runs. And when we see European judges say that they have the right to censor our speech as well in Europe, not just in Europe, but around the world, censor our social media platforms, fine them up to 6%, we start to question our alliance. And we're very tired. America's been playing police officer to the world. We've got some really hurt veterans. We've had terrible wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think this is a different era we're entering into. And so our patience is easily tested, and it's certainly tested when we see Europe turn against what we see as fundamental Enlightenment values like freedom of speech.
Natalie Tocci, has there been an erosion of free speech in Europe?
Well, I don't think there has been, frankly speaking. I mean, certainly it hasn't been my personal experience. I mean, what there has been an increasing amount of is increasing misinformation, disinformation. But what we heard from the US vice president today is that the war on disinformation amounts to the war on democracy. Now, this, frankly speaking, sounds like the Russian playbook in the way in which we have heard for a long time. Yeah, I mean, Russia has always had this incredible sort of slightly perverse ability of completely turning things on its head, and all of a sudden, arguments about democracy or about security were being used precisely for the opposite purpose. And to frankly speaking, hear that kind of rhetoric coming from the US vice president, not in a, you know, not in any conference, right? This was a security conference. So this was basically being presented as the vice president himself put it, the major security threat, both to Europe and to the United States. And on top of it, it has happened, what, you know, less than 2 weeks away from an election in Germany.
Okay.
Right?
Well, can I just come back to you in a moment, Ms. Tocci, and just could I follow on from what she was suggesting there, Michael Schellenberger? And I think J.D. Vance's speech will have come as a surprise to hear this diatribe against about democracy and media freedom from an administration that bans reporters from the White House and empowers unelected billionaires to sack federal employees.
Well, look, first of all, I mean, my news organization applied for a spot at the White House and we didn't get it. So the First Amendment does not protect your right to have a place at the press conference in the White House. All right. We keep in mind, we had the NATO, UK military, American military and intelligence agencies, the think tanks they fund, engaged in elaborate censorship where committees of experts would decide what the truth was and demand censorship by social media platforms on the basis of it. You had Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook just come out and denounce and explain that the Biden administration pressured him to censor the debate on the origins of COVID. They demanded that they censor even true stories of vaccine side effects. Look, the only solution to misinformation is accurate information. You cannot get to the truth if you censor people's debates. I think BBC sometimes spreads misinformation. It would never occur to me to demand censorship by people on BBC, much less to have elaborate, literally think tanks, university departments working with military and intelligence agencies to secretly demand censorship by social media platforms, all of which has been widely reported, by the way, in the British press and the American press. So, I mean, I don't think it compares at all. That is a very, you can't have democracy without freedom of speech.
Natalie Tocci, J.D. Vance speaking in Germany just a couple of weeks away from an election at which the far-right AFD is expected to do quite well. And we've just been told that J.D. Vance has actually gone to meet the leader of the AFD. And I suppose there are those who would say that this is a very deliberate interference in another country's internal affairs.
Well, precisely. I mean, you know, had this been, as I said, in a different, you know, at a different context in a different country, then, you know, part of what J.D. Vance was saying could have even be read indeed in that, you know, sort of purely free speech, you know, advocate for free speech sort of way. But the point is that it's not, right? I mean, the point is that, as I was saying, this is happening days before an election. And indeed, the very fact that J.D. Vance met with Alice Weidel suggests that indeed the way to interpret his remarks at the Munich Security Conference have very little to do with free speech and have a lot to do with election interference and the support for far-right parties in Europe. Because at the end of the day, if those far-right parties in Europe are elected and enter power, essentially, this ends up being not only the end of liberal democracy in Europe, but also the end of European integration, which is a kind of uncomfortable thing to deal with for the US.
That was Natalie Tocci, Italian political scientist and director of the Italian Institute of International Affairs, speaking to me from Munich. And you also heard from Michael Schellenberger, CBR Chair of Politics, Censorship and Free Speech at the University of Austin, and the founder of Public News. He was speaking to me from Austin, Texas. And don't forget, if you want to listen to NewsHour but miss the live broadcast, a podcast of the programme is available, updated twice a day. Just type into your search engine BBC NewsHour podcast and you'll find it there. You can also subscribe to the feed if you want to receive it on a regular basis. Anyway, that's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.